Okay, so we are in this conversation about returning from exile this morning, thinking about homecoming. And homecoming's a tradition that I think all of us have experienced at some point. I did a little research to figure out where the American sort of history of homecoming came from, and there's some debate, but several colleges in the first part of the 20th century started having these celebrations to welcome back their alumni and to sort of build school spirit. There's debate, but Missouri may very well have been the first school to do this. It's not certain. And it was obviously a wildly successful adventure, and so now almost all colleges and high schools have homecomings, and you've probably been to homecoming dances before, or been at a homecoming game, or been around for the homecoming court elections. It's a big deal. And some schools really get into this more than others, right? So some schools go above and beyond the normal staples of football and dance and maybe parade, and they do some really interesting things. So Missouri, the school that maybe started it all, has a really meaningful activity. They do a massive campus blood drive every year for homecoming, and their alumni give blood all over the country, wherever they are, and in honor of their homecoming game. Some folks have less meaningful but still kind of fun traditions. So near my old stomping grounds Virginia Tech has a tradition called the Game Ball Run. For years, they would take the game ball and they would literally run it from Roanoke to Norfolk, which is quite a long run. They never made it on time. And then they changed that tradition, and today they take the game ball for the homecoming game, and the week before the game, it's supposed to travel 100 miles on campus, as every single person on campus is given the opportunity, hopefully, to touch the ball and sort of give it good mojo. But my favorite homecoming tradition is got to be the one at Ball State in Indiana. So Ball State at some point must have had a group of fraternity guys who said, you know what would be really fun? It'd be fun if we put wheels on our beds and we rolled them down the street with people on them. And from that genius idea emerged their special homecoming tradition. So can we play that?
Hey, where's the drums?
You're never going out of style. Ooh, pretty baby, this world might have gone crazy. The way you save me, who could blame me when I just wanna make you smile?
Prince, baby, you're so classic. Whoa, oh, oh, oh. Baby, you're so classic. Yeah, yeah, baby, you're so classic.
Nothing says homecoming like putting someone on their bed and rolling them out of their home, right? So I love that. I love the celebration. And I love this idea that, you know, there's something special, even if it's been a matter of months, right? Even if you graduated in May and it's October, there's something special about coming back to your school, to your home, and celebrating homecoming. So all the more then it seems to me that today, as we think about the Israelites returning to their homes, to their own towns, what an incredible deal that must have been, right? I mean, to think about being gone from your home for 50 to 70 years and coming back for the first time. So I'm going to think today about homecoming. And I want to suggest something really simple. I want to suggest that homecoming is essential for us because we can't rest until we're home. We can't relax until we're home. We can't be complete or be ourselves until we're home. And that life is a journey of homecoming. Life is a journey of homecoming. I think that's the story of Scripture. I think it's the story of our lives. So I want to think about three kinds of homes today and how we kind of come home to them. And the first is the very physical home where we live. The story of our ancestors, of the Jewish people in exile, is a tragedy because, at least this part of the story, they have been ripped from their homes, right? They have been forcibly removed by the Babylonians to relocate, and they've lost that identity. This is not unique to Scripture, unfortunately. It's commonplace in our world. And so Think about the millions of people who had to flee Syria during the most recent civil war there, right, who have been ripped from their homes. My friend Ross Wood, who was here a number of years ago, was a missionary, and he ran a refugee camp in South Sudan. And he had people who lived in that camp and had been living there for decades who were still hoping one day to get to go back, right? Hoping one day the violence and the persecution might end, they might be able to go back home. And so that experience of being removed from our homes is overwhelmingly painful. And there are folks in our midst who have that experience, even in our nation, in a literal sense, who are literally homeless and who are struggling to find a place where they can relax and be at peace and be comforted and be themselves and be complete. But I think all of us, on a larger sense, struggle with this idea a little bit. So one of the challenging components about home for us in our country is that it's become a very impermanent idea. The average American will move at least 12 times in their life. That's incredible, right? 12 times they'll move in their life. By way of comparison, the average European will move 5 to 6 times in their life. Now, that experience of constantly moving around really does begin to challenge a little bit about where home is. So I'm just curious for you, where's home for you? Now, maybe you're blessed to live in a place where you and your family and your parents are, and that's an awesome gift, right? And maybe your family is halfway across the country or halfway around the world. What does home begin to mean for you in that sort of transitional world in which we often live? So I'm thinking about the homecoming of the Israelites. And it occurs to me that after 50 to 70 years, most of the people that come home in the book of Ezra have never set foot in the land of Judah. Right? I mean, there are children who've never been there, and then their parents have never been there. So it's got to be the grandparents, right, who have been telling these stories. It's got to be the grandparents who 50 to 70 years ago were uprooted from their homes, who've been telling stories to their kids and their kids' kids for literally generations. Hey, I know there are good and bad things about this place where we live now, but you need to know this isn't our home. God has a land for us, a land flowing with milk and honey, and it's good, and one day we'll get to go back, and I'll show you where Grandma and Grandpa grew up, and I'll show you the land that God gave us. And he called it the Promised Land, right? And they told those stories around dinner tables and around special meals and around holiday seasons and in the synagogues, if the synagogues were invented then. And they kept the story alive. And it's kind of an incredible thing that just by telling those promises and those stories, keeping that dream alive, that 50,000 people left Babylon and moved to Judea, leaving everything behind, including their jobs and their houses and the places where they and their kids grew up, because of this dream of a home. And so I want to suggest a really simple thing for us to begin this morning. I think that life is a journey of homecoming, and our physical homes are not where we live, and they're not even necessarily where we're from. They're where God calls us to be. Your home is where God calls you to be. So think about the story of Abraham, who is born in Haran, and that's where his ancestors are from, and God calls him out of Haran and into the land of Canaan, and it's a coming home for him. Or think about the Israelites in Egypt during the Exodus. For 400 years, they lived in Egypt. There are no grandparents who've been telling stories. But they're called out of that land of slavery and into the Promised Land, and it's their home. And I think this is critical for us, that where God calls us is home. So, really simple question for you, where is home for you today? Where is your physical home? Where is the place that God has called you to serve and to love and to minister with Him? Where's your home? Second kind of home today is our spiritual home. For us in the church in these last number of months, this has felt like an exile. We haven't been able to be together. We haven't been able to be in this room together. We haven't been able to gather in homes for Bible study. It's been really hard. And it is a gift to be coming back. right? Even if it's slowly, it's a gift. But I'm mindful that even before this COVID thing, so many of our family members ended up in sort of a self-imposed exile. And this is a challenge for us, right? It's a challenge for us in every generation of the church, that we have those that we love, we raise in the church that grow up and move away or grow up and go to college, or and then they just sort of stop coming, right? And their faith sort of falls off. And maybe you've got a friend like that or a child like that or a grandchild like that, and it is really hard, right, to see people that we love not come back home in that sort of spiritual way. So I want to think about that a little bit this morning, and I don't have any great answers, but I have a couple of ideas. One idea is I think that both we who stick around and those who are part of a family who sort of wander off are striving too much for perfection. And I got to tell you, I've had a lot of conversations with folks over the years who've said, hey, you know, I moved away and I couldn't find a church like my home church, so I never found another one. Or, hey, I've got all these issues with the church, all the things the church has done wrong, maybe not this particular church, but the larger organization, and I can't find one that seems to get it all right. And I think, boy, sometimes that strive for perfection can really be a problem for us. So I come back to Ezra, and in the midst of all of those names and listings of horses and mules and donkeys, there was a really interesting little bit where we were told that there were some families who had lost their history, right? They lost their genealogy. They couldn't prove they were really Jewish or really priests, particularly the priests. And so they ended up getting excluded from the priesthood. Now, in a larger sense, this is the Israelites trying to be faithful, right? Trying to say, hey, let's honor the institution of the priesthood. But I got it just sort of bugs me a little bit, right? And I think, boy, here are these people that want to serve God, right? Who have literally left everything to come home to God. And they're being told they're not able to serve because they've lost a piece of paper that says who their mom and dad was. And I think, boy, isn't that, don't we do that, right? Don't we just, we need everything to be so perfect. And if it's not, we just give up on people or on churches. And I think maybe part of the call as we're inviting people to make this a spiritual home or to find a spiritual home in a church is to say, there aren't any perfect churches, right? There aren't any perfect families of faith. There's only a perfect Savior, right? All the rest of us are just trying our best. And let's embrace the fact that God calls imperfect people to do extraordinary things. I also think that we sometimes miss the value of the faith that we pass on to generations. And just as the Jewish people in exile in Babylon told story after story for decade after decade, teaching their kids about this homeland that they've lost, so too I think that we as parents and grandparents and great-grandparents have told those stories to our kids, right? And I think more often than we realize, they bear fruit. Maybe not on the timeline in which we hope they will bear fruit, but they bear fruit. I was talking to a friend in the church a few months ago, and she told me about how she came back to church and back to faith in God, and basically shared that she had grown up in the church as a little kid. Her dad was very involved in church, and then kind of fell away when she got into high school and hadn't been back for decades. And she came back not when her kids were born, but when her kids graduated. And she started reconnecting with the story of her dad and his faith, and that drew her back here. And then something about your welcome and your warmth allowed her to feel at home here. And I thought, that's amazing, right? That those seeds that were planted when she was a child bore fruit after she was an empty nester. And I think this is part of the work of the faith, is to keep telling the stories, right? And trust that the seeds that we've planted may not have sprouted, but neither have they withered. So parents and grandparents, this is a job for you, right? How will you tell the stories around your table and in the holidays and in your home? And how will you show your kids what it means to have a spiritual home so that when they come of an age, they can claim that for themselves? And single people, Today, we did something really sacred, right? We had a baptism where we stood up and we said, we promise to help be parents to Luke, right? We promise to help be spiritual parents. And so we all have this awesome responsibility, right, to help people find their spiritual home, whether it's here, or we don't care what church it is, we just want them to have a church, to have a place where they come to encounter God. And that really brings us to the third kind of home that matters. If life is a journey of homecoming, then the most important homecoming is a recognition that this world isn't home, right? That it's not quite right, that there's something off on how everything is in this world. There's a great scene from the movie The Matrix where Neo, this guy, meets a guru named Morpheus, and they're talking about this experience of feeling like the world isn't quite right. I want to share that scene with you.
I imagine that right now you're feeling a bit like Alice, tumbling down the rabbit hole,
You could say that.
I can see it in your eyes. You have the look of a man who accepts what he sees because he is expecting to wake up. Ironically, this is not far from the truth. Do you believe in fate, Neo?
No.
Why not?
Because I don't like the idea that I'm not in control of my life.
I know exactly what you mean. Let me tell you why you're here. You're here because you know something. What you know you can't explain, but you feel it. You felt it your entire life, that there's something wrong with the world. You don't know what it is, but it's there, like a splinter in your mind, driving you mad. It is this feeling that has brought you to me. Do you know what I'm talking about?
The Matrix.
I love this line that you have a feeling that the world isn't right, like something is off, like there's a splinter in your mind driving you mad. I think this is how we as Christians should see the world, right? We should look around and say, hey, there's poverty here, and that's not right. And there's violence here, and that's not right. And there's broken families here, and that's not right. And this world is clearly not as it should be. And it offers a lot of great stuff, but none of it seems to fix those deep problems. And ultimately, the only hope that we have is to recognize that this isn't our home, that one day there will be a holy city, a new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband, and the home of God will be among mortals, and he will dwell with them, and they will be his peoples, and God himself will be with them. Right? That's our promise. That's our hope, is that yes, absolutely, we have to work in this life, in this world, to try to make our world more like the one that God promises. But we can't be satisfied with this, right? What the world offers isn't going to be enough to meet the needs of our heart. St. Augustine says, our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. And so we have all the great heroes of our faith who recognize in some sense that their life isn't complete here. And they're striving for something more. Hebrews 11 has this great roll of faith, all these heroes that starts with Abraham and goes all the way to David. And it says in the middle, all these died in faith without having received the promises, but from a distance they saw and greeted them. They confessed that they were strangers and foreigners on the earth, for people who speak in this way make it clear they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of the land they had left behind, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God. Indeed, he has prepared a city for them. This is the beauty of how Scripture works for us, right? The Old Testament tends to be this incredible physical foreshadowing of the spiritual promise of God. So in the Old Testament, the people of Israel are literally in Babylon looking for a Jerusalem they can go home to. But we are in this world of Babylon, right? This world that promises us that if you just get enough money or enough power or enough fame or enough security or enough affluence or influence, then eventually you'll be content, right? Just keep cramming all that stuff into your heart until it fills up. And our God says, no, I'm the only thing that'll fill you up, right? I'm the only place that you'll feel at home. And so our call is to keep our eyes focused on that new Jerusalem, right? That home is where we can fully be with the one who loves us most. And it means that we have to live in this world, yes, to reform it into God's image, but also we kind of walk softly, right? We don't leave a big imprint. We don't put down our roots here. There was a story of an American tourist, I believe this is a true story, who in the 19th century went to visit a famous Polish rabbi named Hofitz Chaim. He walked into the rabbi's house, and he was astonished to see that his home was really just one room, and the room had pretty much just a bunch of books and a table and a bench. And this tourist said, "Rabbi, where is your furniture?" And the rabbi said, "Where is yours?" And the tourist said, "Well, I mean, I don't live here. I'm just passing through." And Hofitz Chaim said, "So am I. So am I. That we are a people that are passing through. Doesn't mean we can't enjoy the blessings of this world. Doesn't mean that we can't make a difference in this world. But we can't ever let it try to meet our heart's needs, right? Our hearts are restless until they find our rest in Him." So this life journey of homecoming to God, I think, is beautifully summarized by Ralph Waldo Emerson. He says this, "Goodbye, proud world, I'm going home. Thou art not my friend, and I'm not thine. Long through the weary crowds I roam, a river ark on the ocean brine. Long I've been tossed like the driven foam, and now, proud world, I'm going home. Oh, when I am safe in my sylvan home, I tread on the pride of Greece and Rome. And when I am stretched beneath the pines where the evening star so holy shines, I laugh at the lore and the pride of man, at the sophist schools and the learned clan. For what are they all in their high conceit when man in the bush with God may meet?" Life is a journey of homecoming to God. So one last thing for us. Life's a journey of homecoming to God, and it's never too late to come home. It's never too late to come home. This is one of the coolest stories or the coolest parts of the story of Ezra for me. So we've mentioned that we've had a couple of homecoming journeys where people left Babylon and came back. We've mentioned that it took about 100 years for the majority of those exiles to return. But a lot of exiles stay. They stay in Babylon. They don't come back with Sheshbazzar or Zerubbabel or with Ezra or with Nehemiah. They stay not just for centuries, but millennia, right? For thousands of years, there's this booming Jewish community in what used to be Babylon, all the way up until the 20th century. And in the 1940s, as the modern state of Israel is being formed, David Ben-Gurion, who's sort of the George Washington of the modern state of Israel, said this, "Almost the whole community of Babylonian exiles who stayed when Babylon was destroyed came to this country 10 years ago. And their number was nearly thrice the number of those who returned to Zion in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah." That's so cool to me that it's not just 50 years later or 70 years later or 100 years later, but 3,400 years later, people are still coming home. And that's the promise of our God, right? It never runs out. It never wears thin. You can't do anything to lose it or earn it. You can't ever do anything so bad that God won't make a place for you in His home. Whatever your life might be like, He is always calling us back. He's always calling us to come and make His home with us. He wants us to come home so much that He sent His Son to die for us so that we might live forever with Him. And so, three really simple questions for us today. The first is, where is your physical home? Where has God called you in this life to serve and to minister and to love and to work with Him? And second, how are you making this your spiritual home? And how are you calling and inviting others to be part of our journey with God together? And third, how are you keeping your eyes focused on Jesus and on the promise that one day God will make His home among mortals? And He will wipe every tear from every eye, and death and sorrow and sickness will be no more, and He will make all things new. Thanks be to God.